You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 16th of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from Studio One at Midori House. I'm Clemency Burton-Hill and I'm joined by Chloe Potter.
Coming up on today's programme, as the World Press Photo Exhibition tours the globe, we'll discuss the best of this year's international photojournalism.
We'll also be asking why Vancouver has become such a sci-fi TV hotspot.
After X-Files became a hit, more shows took advantage of Vancouver's spooky natural beauty. I mean, our province's slogan here is Supernatural British Columbia. It's supposed to mean just super and natural, but really, there is something spooky about the mist.
And in our weekly music review, we'll meet the conductor of Britain's most innovative and versatile classical ensemble, Aurora Orchestra.
Plus, we have cultural recommendations from Rio and we'll be meeting one of Warsaw's leading art critics. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review, right here on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show. As I say, we are live from Studio One in Midori House, and I'm delighted to be finally presenting a show with Chloe Potter. I feel like we've been passing like ships in the night.
We have indeed. It's lovely. And I think at times people have thought we're the same person because we're never in the same place at once.
Chloe,
but finally we're together.
And what have you been up to this week, Chloe? Have you seen anything great?
I have actually. I've seen, it's a bit of rich pickings. But one thing I really wanted to recommend was a film I saw directed by Sarah Polley, who directed Take This Waltz, with Michelle Williams in it.
Who I love.
Yes, absolutely. It's such a colourful, vibrant and a quirky take on that kind of romantic film. Kind of inverted, isn't it? But the film I really wanted to recommend is a kind of anthropological documentary that she's made called Stories We Tell, which looks at her own family and is made up of lots of different interviews from relatives and addresses a kind of family secret. And it's just a really fascinating look at the way we tell stories, the way memory works and social memory, and how we distort the past through the way we remember things. And I won't say any more, but if you find yourself with a spare couple of hours, definitely seek it out. It's called Stories We Tell.
Sounds fantastic. Well, we will be telling lots of stories on today's review here on Monocle 24.
First up on this week's review, we turn to the notorious impact that an image can have. For over 55 years, the World Press Photo Contest has encouraged the highest standards in photojournalism. This year's prize winners are as varied and thought-provoking as ever, from a powerful portrait of Chinese artist Ai Weiwei to a flamboyant bullfighter captured in full flourish to the haunting eyes of an orphan of the financial crash via lions and penguins and colourful Olympic athletes.
The exhibition is currently on show in no less than 45 different countries around the world, including Austria, Spain, Canada, Japan, Switzerland and Portugal. So there are plenty of opportunities to see the prize-winning images which tour the world and can be seen in over 100 locations. Well, joining us to give her take on this year's selection is the freelance journalist Christine Jun. A very warm welcome to The Review, Christine. Lovely to have you with us.
Hello, thank you for having me.
There's such a dazzling selection of photographs this year. I have to just ask you what your favourites have been and why.
Oh, thanks for asking. Well, first up, I'd say that the most intriguing photo for me was from John Gurra from Denmark, who won first prize in sports feature stories. He captured a portrait of Somalian young women who risked their lives daily to play basketball. Radical Islamic groups have actually banned women from playing sports, considering it un-Muslim. And the punishment for that currently is to cut off their right hand or foot. So these women are literally fighting for their freedom and their life every day on the court. And just the commitment and the passion, the authority in these young women's faces, it just struck a chord. I've never seen such personal strength and just grit and resilience in real life.
That's the thing, isn't it, Christine? And Clemmy, a photo, we could talk about a single one of these photos for the entire time we have for this segment. You know, it's a cliche to say that a picture tells a thousand words, but each one of these photos, you know, you can stand and look at it and thinks it makes you think so much about a particular place in the world, a particular set of people. It's such a powerful thing, isn't it? I was particularly affected by one that we mentioned in the introduction, the eyes of an orphan. Well, it's the eyes of a child. And until you read the description, you don't know what it is. It's a black and white image, and it's almost through a car window of a young child, his eyes staring out. And you read the blurb and discover that he's the sole survivor of a family suicide attempt resulting from the financial crash. And you know, it just hits you, wham.
I think I remember that shot.
It's incredible. Christine, what do you think about the fact that, you know, we're living in this post-digital age? Everyone's a photographer. Everyone has a smartphone in their back pocket, you know, whether they're Instagramming away or if they're actually, you know, have some, you know, natural talent, let's say. What's your reaction to the exhibition in the wake of that? And do you think we see photographs differently now? And is there a way that these photographs really stand out because they're taken in a certain way or with a certain eye?
Absolutely. I think that, especially for my generation, we're so inundated every day with social media, reality TV. On YouTube, you could see someone being beheaded. You know, of course, that has an effect of, you know, desensitizing us and making us more cynical when we look at these kinds of, you know, even the greatest human atrocities can now barely compete with, you know, Kim Kardashian's.
Isn't she one of the greatest human atrocities? Sorry, did I say that?
You know, one of her problems. No, sorry, that was bad. No, but I just mean that, you know, we're so used to looking at heavily manipulated images with filters that are very sensationalist and extreme in nature. So obviously that affects the way we look at, you know, photos now, even if they are quite authentic and are just, you know, for data purposes.
What do you think the difference is between an image having a requisite power to make people think about things and becoming exploitative? You know, the winning image of this year's exhibition shows two dead children being carried through the streets of Gaza. At what point does a photograph become exploitative of someone's misery?
I think that's a really fine line, especially these days when everyone's so eager to play paparazzi, not just to world events, but to their own lives or the people around them, to make a buck or make a name for themselves based on other people suffering misery. I remember the photo that you're talking about, taken by Paul Hansen. And I have to say that it was so real that for me it became unreal. I think that's a very typical reaction, to feel this emotional distance just because of the way it was composed. A lot of these older men are compressed into a narrow alleyway in Gaza City. And for me, the shot was, it reminded me of Fellini, actually. It was very cinematic. And because there's only men in the photo, wailing, angry, holding these two dead children, my first thought was, where are the women?
And it numbs your reaction to it.
Would it have had more impact for you if it had been two mothers with their two dead children?
No, not necessarily. I think that's more of a cliche image. But just given the nature of the story, once you read the blurb, that, you know, these are the uncles carrying the family members through the streets on the way to the mosque for the funeral, you know, the father was also killed. It was due to an Israeli airstrike.
In general, though, do you think that female photojournalists and alternative voices are well represented in the exhibition as a whole?
I'd say that they could have been more, to be honest. Not to count or anything, but I think it was roughly one-fifth female photojournalists.
So you did count.
Quite right. Not to count or anything.
Well, I mean,
where are all the women?
We do make up 50% of the population on Earth. So, you know, I'd say that equal representation is the least of the things that we can demand.
Christine, how do you feel, is there a difference between the way you critique photography and a fine art exhibition?
I can't speak for everyone, but I personally do, just because I'm so used to staring for such a long time at paintings or more artistic photographs. I'd just say that, you know, sort of roughly speaking for me, when I look at a piece of fine art, there's like a multiplicity of meanings. There's a multi-layeredness to it. Whereas when you look at photojournalism, it's more one-sided. It's data, it's evidence, it's proof. So, you know, that's the beauty of it, though, as well, is that, you know, you don't just
look at it for hours and say, oh, I didn't get it, you know, I'm an idiot, and walk out. This is something that everyone could actually appreciate and enjoy, because you do get it.
What are the other images that really stood out for you?
I have to say that a more quiet one, to be honest, by Ananda van der Pluim, I think. I'm sorry if I butchered her name. From Denmark, who won the third prize in contemporary portraits. It was a contrast to a lot of the others that were much more explosive and theatrical and sensationalist. Because it was quite contained in a picture of her half-brother that she hadn't seen for a decade, who was young and jobless, with no qualifications. I think he was about 18. And it just was a everyday portrait of alienation and loneliness I think everyone can identify with. Tragedy doesn't always have to be on such a huge scale in order for it to be real.
And interesting how the camera can make an uncomfortable situation between two people potentially more bearable, more comfortable. It said she used her camera to try to sort of get to know her brother again after their decade of not knowing each other.
Absolutely.
I have to say, one that struck me of really being of the year, I guess, was the portrait of Ai Weiwei, which Renaissance feel to it, really ancient feel, the way the lighting was used in the portrait. And yet there in the foreground, he's holding his kind of personalized iPhone. And you know, it really symbolizes, it's almost a kind of icon-esque image. And it really symbolized that access and freedom that the internet and that he accesses through his phone has given him. And allowed him to communicate with the world. I thought that was a really powerful...
Absolutely hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's also, you know, legitimizing for himself as an Asian artist within the Western canon. Taking a portrait that reminds you of a Renaissance portrait by Hans Holbein.
Exactly.
Christine Jin, thank you so much for joining us here on The Review. The World Press Photo Exhibition is currently on in London and 44 other cities around the globe simultaneously, with more being added in the coming weeks. So lots of opportunity to get to your nearest location and see the images for yourself. Worldpressphoto.org has all of the listings.
Do stay with us here on The Review. We'll be back shortly for our in-house comment piece.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Chloe Potter, and Clemency Burton-Hill. It's time now to turn to Monocle's editors and journalists to get their take on a new opening or performance. Today, it's the turn of producer Daniel Giacopelli, who took some time out recently to see The National on their European tour.
There's a certain type of band you thank God you discovered, that you recommend to everyone you meet, and then immediately regret you ever opened your mouth. I thought about this on a Wednesday night at Alexandria Palace in North London, where seemingly every bespectacled 20 and 30-something in the capital poured, pushed, and crowded into the first of two sold-out shows by these guys.
Stand up straight at the foot of your love. I lift my shirt up. I was carried.
The National are from Ohio, via Brooklyn, and made up of two pairs of brothers, along with their tall, gangly, three-piece suit-wearing, patchy facial-haired lead singer, Matt Berninger.
I can see the glowing lights. I
can see them every night.
The National have only recently become indie megastars. They lurked in the word-of-mouth netherworlds for years, known by a community of fans astonished at their lack of mainstream success. That's all until High Violet, their 2010 release, put them on the map. All previous work, Boxer, Alligator, and Sad Songs for Dirty Lovers, were loved by a dedicated cult following. But this rarely leads to riches and fame in the short term. With Trouble Will Find Me, the National have done it, cemented their fame. They pack out gigantic venues now, one of which I was headed to. But the first challenge was getting there. Alexandria Palace, known here affectionately as Ali Pally, is in the middle of nowhere. From Midori House, where I began, it took a few underground train rides, buses, a one-pound shuttle, and a walk. But I made it, along with seemingly everyone else. Ali Pally is huge. A favorite venue here, the People's Palace. The building itself is big, historic, and beautiful. 7 acres surrounded by almost 200 more of greenery, all sat snug on a big hill. When Matt and his band started, the crowd hushed. A few old songs, a few new ones, a joke or two, and an announcement about a missing band member's new baby in New York. Matt's voice was a bit hoarse, but no matter. The crowd shuffled around, swaying and jumping, eyeing the big, gigantic, high-definition screen, unlike anything I've ever seen at a live gig, and was slowly getting charged. Oh, and then of course came their ode to this rainy city.
Summer sun a runner through the weather that I'm running for the feeling that I lost today. Summer sun a runner for the feeling that I lost today.
The National have made it big, and though massive crowds have replaced hush shows in front of hundreds, I have no buyer's remorse. For Monocle, I'm Daniel Giacopelli.
This is The Review on Monocle 24. Well, some music now of a different kind, because it's time for our weekly music review, and we're going to hear something a bit different for the show today. We're venturing into the wild world of classical music, but with a twist.
Hailed as the UK's most versatile musical ensemble, Aurora Orchestra have an eclectic and innovative approach to classical programming, forging adventurous collaborations across disciplines, genres and artistic frontiers. Safe to say, they refuse to be bound by convention. Recently back from a tour to Shanghai and about to launch their new season in London tonight, we're delighted to be joined on the line by Nicholas Collin, chief conductor and co-founder of Aurora. Nick, you founded the orchestra back in 2005 when you were in your early 20s. Tell us a bit more about how Aurora came to be and some more about your untypical ethos.
Hi, nice to be speaking to you today. I suppose Aurora was started because there are a few of us the same generation at university who wanted to get our fellow players, fellow instrumentalists of the same generation together, really, and just to make music. It was that simple at the beginning. We put on a concert in LSO St. Luke's near Old Street in London. And from there, it really took off. It's now been, 8, 9 years, and the orchestra has changed shape hugely, and it's gone in different directions that we could have never guessed it would have gone in, I suppose. And now, I suppose, for all of us, it's become something which attempts to reshape how classical music is perceived, how the chamber orchestra can be accessed by people. So it's really like giving the sort of chamber orchestra a new vision and trying to bring people into the concert hall who might otherwise not want to be engaged with this kind of music.
Nick, the orchestra's had an amazing impact all around the world. You were recently in Shanghai. It's clearly sort of made massive waves in the classical world. Were you at all surprised by the impact that it's had and the fact that very conservative classical critics have been just so dazzled by what you do, especially in terms of how you redefine the classical concert-going experience?
Well, I suppose remembering the early days of when we started out, everything was on a very, very small scale. It was all, you know, kitchen table work, starting the orchestra from nothing.
And now you're selling out the proms with 6,000 people.
Well, yeah, and lots of orchestras are sort of started and you get the seeds of an idea and quite a lot of them fizzle out because it's a hugely expensive thing to try and make work. And also, it's a difficult market. It's, you know, in somewhere like London, there's loads and loads of orchestras. And I suppose you could say, if you were being slightly negative, you could say that the audiences, you know, aren't growing. So it's really, for us, it's been, I suppose, one of the reasons of its success has been just trying to tap into new audiences. Because we're convinced about the power of the music that we play, so we hope that other people will be as well.
Yes, I'm sure you're going to change that. Audiences are set to grow, Nicholas. Nicholas, you've very kindly chosen a few tracks for us to listen to today. The first one, Mad World, Gary Jules. This is one that you're due to be performing tonight.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I suppose what's quite interesting about our concert tonight, and it's the same with lots of our concerts, that the repertoire that we choose is very versatile and very different. So, for example, we've got a big piece by Mahler, a big, huge song cycle. It's about an hour long. Not many groups, I suppose, would put in a song. We put in Mad World into that concert. It's not the kind of thing you'd normally see in there. But for us, I suppose, we view it as music and music that can be put together and can be illuminated by one another. And the song itself is so beautiful. It sort of sets up this fantasy world. It's trying to give like a sort of really cohesive unity to the whole programme.
Okay, let's have a listen, shall we?
Yeah.
Here it is, Mad World by Gary Jules.
No expression. Hide my head, I wanna drown my sorrow. No tomorrow, no tomorrow. And I find it kind of funny, I find it kind of sad. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you.
Mad World by Gary Jules. That song was, of course, in the movie Donnie Darko as well. Nick, I believe that you're going to, as you say, you're going to be hearing that song tonight at your launch at LSO St Luke's, your season launch, I should say, sung by a rather brilliant young British tenor called Andrew Staples. And I think he's going to be singing in the next track that you've chosen for us, which is a Monocle 24 review exclusive, and it's Mahler. Tell us more about this piece, because it's called Das Lied von der Erde, and one thing that really intrigues me about it is that the astrophysicist Brian Cox, Professor Brian Cox, said that if he'd had his way, he would have put Mahler across his amazing TV series The Wonders of the Solar System and The Wonders of the Universe, because Mahler really has a way of just describing the whole universe.
I didn't know that he said that. For me, I mean, Mahler is the composer who looks most at the idea of like where we are on this tiny little earth of ours and how we fit into the cosmos. I mean, this piece was written in like 1909, 1910. It's the most wonderful, all-embracing piece of art that I can think of, actually. He just says in this hour-long piece, he says everything that you can say. And it's sad, but it's also filled with happiness and some musings about our place on this world. So yeah, this is a bit, I think, from the first movement with Andy Staples, this wonderful tenor, that we recorded live in Germany.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that was Mahler's Das Lied von der Erde, not something that you hear every day here on Monocle 24.
Nick, I wanted to ask you about some of the collaborations that Aurora do. You collaborate with all sorts of other creative types, artists, filmmakers, and one of your collaborations is with a really impressive, another musician, another individual in the music world who's making real waves, Nico Muhly, the New York-based composer. He's recently had his opera Two Boys on at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. Tell us about your collaboration with him.
Well, actually, we've known each other for a long time, and we commissioned various works from Nico about 4 or 5 years ago, and we released a disc of his music on Decca. So we've had a long relationship with him. He's one of the most versatile and just intuitive and like brilliantly imaginative composers that I know. So he's doing a few beautiful little arrangements for us for a countertenor that we both know called Yeston Davis, who in my opinion is probably the best countertenor in the world, a young British guy. So he's doing that for a concert we're doing in May. So that's really exciting because he's such a wonderful composer.
And Nick, why is it so important to forge these collaborations?
Well, I suppose for us, we started doing them probably about 5 years ago with the realisation that people, particularly of our generation, I suppose, needed or sometimes wanted another hook, another way in to a classical or, you know, an orchestral concert. And I suppose always we've been aware that we don't want to dumb that down or create a sort of gimmick out of it, but really provide another way in. So we can do challenging repertoire that might otherwise seem austere or just too difficult to understand in some ways. But with another way in through, I don't know, film, literature, dance, whatever it might be, just gives another dimension to that piece of music and can draw a sort of wider audience into the concert hall.
Well, Nick, we're going to hear Motion, which is from that Decca disc, Seeing is Believing. It's by Nico Muhly and performed by Aurora Orchestra. Have a wonderful launch at LSO St Luke's tonight. Hope you have a really fantastic season. Nicholas Collin, Artistic Director, Music Director of Aurora Orchestra, thank you very much for joining us here on The Review. And here it is, Motion by Nico Muhly. Something a little different for our music review here on Monocle 24's review. We heard Nico Muhly's Motion, that's from the disc Seeing is Believing, and earlier we were talking to Nicholas Collin, Chief Conductor of Aurora Orchestra.
Time now for our weekly cultural guide from a city around the world. Today we're headed to Rio, and our correspondent Sheena Rossiter is here to guide us through what's on.
With summer quickly approaching south of the equator, traffic in Rio de Janeiro slowly inches along as tourists start to flood this beach metropolis, escaping the harsh northern hemisphere winters. Well, that and the seemingly countless roadworks and infrastructure improvements for the upcoming World Cup and Summer Olympics don't exactly make urban mobility much faster either. Of course, these are just signs of a city in transformation. And visitors to Rio de Janeiro can have a glimpse at what the city once was at the Elio Ochisica Municipal Art Center downtown, which is currently hosting the Urban Transformation in Rio Biennial. Put on by the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro, it shows the city of Samba's expansion and how it's becoming a safer place as City Hall slowly installs Unified Classified Police Units, UPP, in the city's favelas. Live performances, installations, paintings, sculptures, and videos highlight the changes in Rio, including photos that show protests that continue to rock the city's core, coincidentally not far from where the exhibit is being held. Yeah. But for Rio visitors looking for a more interactive gallery experience, they can head over to Botafogo, where they can experience the Matriz da Voz exhibit in Casa Daros. The show, created by Mexican artist Rafael Luanzo Emmer, gets visitors to speak, sing, or scream into an intercom, which then flashes lights and patterns along the surrounding four walls that corresponds with the visitor's voice. Depending on the pitch of the person's voice, the lights flash different wavelengths that reflect the frequency that was produced by the vocals. Since 2011, the exhibit has been to places like New York, Copenhagen, and Sydney, allowing people to draw with their voices. And until March next year, those passing through Rio can create their own temporary art through vocal expression at the Matriz da Voz exhibit. But with tropical temperatures all year round, it's always summer in Rio. And it's fair to say that most people don't come to Rio de Janeiro to be cooped up inside. Let's face it, they come for the world-famous beaches and the vibrant Brazilian beach culture that goes along with it. For those who are just looking for a typical Carioca weekend, having a nice ice-cold caipirinha cocktail along Copacabana Beach is always a good default for a lazy and relaxing Sunday. And with the World Beach Soccer Tournament taking place in Rio de Janeiro, those lazing on the beach can get a glimpse of yet another national pastime. With the semi-finals on Saturday and the final on Sunday, Copacabana beachgoers can see world-renowned football clubs like FC Barcelona, AC Milan, and popular Brazilian club Corinthians compete for the title, all free of charge. An appetizer for the World Cup, if you will. For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. Do stay with us. Next up, we'll be assessing Warsaw's current art openings.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Chloe Potter.
We're crossing to Warsaw now to get a critic's view on events in the city. Reporter Gulliver Cragg spoke to one of the city's most prominent critics, Sebastian Cichocki, at the Museum of Modern Art, where he's a curator.
A voice outside the door spells out the word museum on a building that was known to Poles for years as their country's finest furniture showroom. The 1970s Emilia Pavilion is due to be demolished soon, much to the regret of critic and curator Sebastian Cichocki, who is deputy director of the Modern Art Museum that set up its temporary home there.
We love the building so much. It has a great rhythm. The place is amazing and it looks very good. It's very transparent, so it's visible from the outside, and it's very well attended as well. People just love the building.
And it's free.
And it's free, of course. Yeah.
Now you've amassed a collection, right?
Yeah, the thing is that we are building everything from the scratch. You know, there was no building, no collection, nothing to inherit somehow. But now we started to collect a few years ago, and now it's really it's growing rapidly. It's an international collection. We have artworks from all over the globe, and now we decided that it's time to show it. We have also a kind of mission of bringing the Polish artists to the international kind of recognition. I have to say, of course, you know, Polish artists are doing quite well, and this art scene is still flourishing. It's still very active, and there are still so many like new upcoming young artists who are really amazing. So this is, I'm quite optimistic about the state of Polish art scene in the future.
So I guess it's a good time to ask you about the Polish Turner Prize, as it were, the Polish equivalent of the Turner Prize, the Deutsche Bank Views, it's called.
This is something which really shows the condition of Polish art scene. People are really into it.
Does it trigger as much controversy as the Turner Prize used to do in England every year?
I think the contemporary art in Poland, it's still not a kind of popular issue. So it's not like being discussed in the national newspapers and so on. But there is quite a number of people who are really into the subject, and they discuss it quite emotionally. So this year, the committee selected 5 artists, young artists.
As far as I can see, 4 out of the 5 selected artists do video.
It's quite a tendency. You can even call it like a kind of cinematic turn in the Polish art. It's quite dominant, it's quite present. Karolina Braguła and Agnieszka Polska produced films which might be, you can imagine them as being screened in the cinemas. They are really kind of attractive. The artists are capable of producing those super tempting, sensual images. But you can still see that they are somehow obsessed with the art history, with the past, that especially in the case of Agnieszka Polska, who is one of the most talented Eastern European artists, she's kind of excavating those avant-garde corpses and animating them somehow. So in her movie called The Future Days, she uses that artist, quite famous artists as Bastian Aderli Lozano or Włodzimierz Borowski, who are already dead. And she depicted this paradise, the heaven, which is being inhabited by that artist. They are just walking aimlessly, being completely impotent when it comes to producing any new things, because they lost the basic drive for producing artworks, which is the fear of death. So I think especially Agnieszka Polska shows like a new quality in the Polish art.
And the third thing that you wanted to talk to me about is the Wojciech Bąkowski exhibition, which is opening at the Stereo Gallery, which is now on Żelazna Street in Warsaw, having moved from Poznan, is that right?
Yes, I have to say it's a kind of legendary gallery, and it has a really like a cult status among art lovers. It's known for creating this kind of movement called penerstwo. Penerstwo is a Poznań slang term for like cool hooligans who are really also sensitive. They cooperate with a group of artists who deal not only with visual art, but also with music, with street art, and many other activities. Wojciech Bąkowski is definitely like the most recognized of them. He is already known as a musician. He's the leader of 2 quite famous hip-hop bands.
So what's he showing, though, in this particular exhibition?
I think that Wojciech Bąkowski represents this kind of post-internet aesthetics. He's very much influenced by those early computer programs and effects. He's using, for example, effects from basic Windows Media Player. He's using the remnants of something of this kind of early digital hype. I think that the exhibition, which is going to be opened this Friday, will be a kind of summary of this kind of exploration of the super domestic territory, which is being infected by this digital virus.
That was Sebastian Cichocki speaking to Gulliver Crag in Warsaw. This is The Review on Monocle 24, and we are finishing the show today by crossing over to Vancouver.
Regular Review host Gillian Tobias caught up with Kim Linekin, CBC's pop culture columnist, to talk about what TV is hot in the city. The answer? Sci-fi.
Kim, I'm fascinated because you've brought for us a trio of series that all have sci-fi in common. Can you talk a little bit about Vancouver as a base for this kind of filmmaking and television making?
Well, it is weird because you think of sci-fi being futuristic modern, and Vancouver is known for its natural beauty. So, but it just so happens, I mean, it's sci-fi and fantasy, both kind of halves of the genre. And I think it happened in the early 90s when the X-Files came here. And it was actually, the X-Files pilot was supposed to be shot in L.A. That's where the creator was from and all the actors, but they couldn't find suitable locations there. So they decided to go where the good forests are. So I think it also helped that our dollar was much cheaper than in the U.S. and there were very good tax incentives. Those have since been clawed back a little. Plus good local crews, because there has been a lot of filmmaking in B.C. in the last 30 years or so. And then after X-Files became a hit, more shows took advantage of Vancouver's spooky natural beauty. I mean, our province's slogan here is Supernatural British Columbia. It's supposed to mean just super and natural, but really there is something spooky about the mist. It's because of the rain and the forests that it looks so spooky.
I'm from the East Coast, and I always associated Vancouver with granola and open-toed sandals. Perhaps I'm wrong.
Well, I think there's a little bit of crossover between the granola and the supernatural sci-fi kind of thing. So I think also Vancouver benefits from having this range of neighborhoods. We have Edwardian row houses with gleaming glass and concrete modern condos, and dirt-poor flop houses. We have kind of the gas town area, which is used a lot for the TV show Fringe because it looks like dirty alleys in New York. So we can kind of double for any major or minor city.
Well, you've brought us a little kind of Red Riding Hood basket of three different series that have just opened. So we're going to have a listen to the first one, and then we'll talk about it. The first one is Once Upon a Time in Wonderland. Let's have a listen.
Okay.
You think you have the advantage, but you don't.
I'm not the one whose friend is turned to stone and whose love is in my possession. Now, you can carry on behaving like the little girl you were when we very first met. Now you can grow up and do what common sense compels you to do. Either way, you know where to find me.
You're not going to put me in prison? Torture me? Let me rot until I do your bidding?
Don't you see, darling? You are in prison. What do you think Wonderland is?
Hmm. And we were just listening to an excerpt of Once Upon a Time in Wonderland, a new series that was just made in Vancouver. Can you set up, what is the premise of this series?
It's about Alice, a young woman from Victorian England who's in psychiatric treatment in the first episode because she keeps insisting she just came from a different world down in a rabbit hole. That's kind of a clever premise. In the first episode, she misses her lost love, Cyrus, a genie, and the white rabbit appears and leads her back through the rabbit hole to rescue him. So this is her second time in Wonderland. Cyrus is being held prisoner by two baddies, Jafar, who you may remember as the villain from Aladdin. He's played by Naveen Andrews from Lost, and the Red Queen, played by young actress Emma Rigby. So they want Sophie to make her three wishes already so that Cyrus won't be her genie anymore and they can use him for their own nefarious purposes. And what you just heard there is where the Red Queen lets Sophie go after she's tried and failed to rescue her friend, the Knave of Hearts.
So from what you've seen, do you think this series will catch on? And who's it aimed at? Who will the audience be?
From what I've seen, this show is aimed at kind of 12-year-olds, especially girls. It's a very female empowerment show, and I think it'll do well for them. It's also a spin-off of Once Upon a Time that's been on for 2 years already. That show has done really well, been a big success for ABC. This show was conceived as a winter hiatus replacement, but it's now running at the same time. It's still just going to have a limited run. It hasn't gotten great ratings so far, but I think if it gets a chance for a second season, it'll really take off. I would say one of my criticisms is it's too much CGI. It doesn't seem to have a realistic town center like Storybrooke from Once Upon a Time. And it also feels a bit underpopulated. Alice and her lover, Cyrus, they're not together. And so you're rooting for this love story that you don't really have any investment in. And to be honest, Cyrus certainly isn't interesting enough to carry a whole series. Alice is played by Sophie Lowe, an actress from Sheffield who was raised in Australia. She's really great. The villains, Naveen Andrews does a good job as Jafar. Emma Rigby, I haven't quite cottoned on to as the Red Queen. But I'd still say this series drew me in. I watched it again, the latest episode last night. And I kind of like that both Once Upon a Time and this spinoff are very female driven. All the women are rescuing the men all the time. And here we have Cyrus as pretty much the damsel in distress. He's locked away in a tower and it's up to Alice to go and rescue him. There's kind of a fun gender swap swap going on there. It's very female empowerment, and I think that's good for 12-year-olds who might want to watch this.
And of course, when you think of Alice in Wonderland, the potential there for whether it's sci-fi or fantasy fiction is huge when it comes to filmmaking.
Yes, and they do a good job of that. I mean, that's mostly with the CGI, but they do have, the White Rabbit is voiced by John Lithgow, but he is actually an animated rabbit and looks kind of interesting. And I don't remember if I've seen The Cheshire Cat, but yes, there's so much potential there. And already it's better than the Tim Burton film from a few years ago. So
Let's move on to your second series. This was also made in Vancouver. It's called The Tomorrow's People. We're going to have a listen and you can then tell us more about it.
How did you do that?
You've heard of telepathy? It's another one of our powers.
The three T's, the third being telekinesis.
He doesn't believe us.
It's funny, the teleporting usually sells it.
No offense, but any second I'm gonna wake up someplace awful. Maybe another three-way at my neighbor's place.
You don't understand, Stephen. You're one of us. You're breaking out.
You're waking up in weird places, Stephen. You're not sleepwalking. You're teleporting. You hear Kara's voice in your head? That's telepathy. Your latent powers are starting to appear.
And that was a clip of the Tomorrow People, choice of our guest, Kim Leinken. I'm going to have to ask you to set this one up as well, as I was very confused by that sound up.
Okay. This is about a teenager named Stephen Jameson. He wakes up in his neighbor's bed one night between the husband and wife and gets hauled back to his mom's house. They all think that he's got a sleepwalking problem and that he just needs to take more pills for his mental issues. But then he's whisked away in the subways to this underground lair of the Tomorrow People, a bunch of young pretty people who have genetically evolved to have supernatural powers. They're basically X-Men mutants, only we don't call it that. So that's that scene you heard him meeting Kara and John. So they're the other two stars of the show, and they've known their Tomorrow People for a little bit longer. And the twist here in this show is that the Tomorrow People are being hunted by an organization called Ultra that fears them and fears their powers and wants to recruit a few of them to neutralize the others. And it seems, the other twist is that Stephen joins Ultra because his uncle is the head of it, and the only way Stephen's going to find his missing father is by kind of teaming up with the enemy. So that part is actually interesting because the uncle isn't just a straight ahead bad guy. He makes some good points about why Stephen might want to switch to their side. So there's an interesting twist there, but I got to say the actual actors, except for the lead, Robbie Amell, who plays Stephen, he's 25. He's playing a 16-year-old, mind you. That's not too realistic, but he's a good actor. So I liked following his story. I'm kind of intrigued what happens with him. All the rest of them are pretty generic kind of X-Men-y type, so second-rate X-Men.
Made in Canada, do you think this will have international potential?
I would say so. I mean, I'm wondering if it'll come to the UK because it is based on an ITV children's show from the 70s. So I would think there's a curiosity factor for people in the UK to see how it's been updated. I didn't get a chance to look at the original series. I'm assuming this is pitched more at teens and young adults rather than as a children's show. But I think everything superhero is just going viral all around the world. So I think it has a shot.
The next series you've brought our attention to is Almost Human, and it seems to me that the production values of this one is much more intense than the other ones. We're going to have a listen to it now.
I was decommissioned 4 years ago, as you know. All of us were. Why am I in this car with you?
I'm required to ride with the synthetic.
I'm not a huge fan of that term. St. Christopher. This has to be a gift from someone, am I right? Something like 80% of these are given as gifts.
Synthetics are precise.
There's that term again.
You just said something like 80%.
The actual statistic is 83.42%. But I'm running my colloquialism routine, so I express most data conversationally, man.
Terrific.
Almost Human, an excerpt from a new series by Fox. This, I gather, is a kind of a Blade Runner futuresque series about a cop and a synthetic android?
So Almost Human is made by the people who made Lost and Star Trek and Fringe. It's set in 2048 Los Angeles when crime has gotten so bad that there aren't enough cops to go around. So each cop is paired with an android. And our lead cop here is Detective John Kennix. He's played by Carl Urban, who you know as Bones from Star Trek. He's lost his leg and all his friends in an ambush. And he got so depressed from that he went off the force for about a year. And in this episode, the first episode, he's brought back by his boss, played by Lily Taylor. And At first, he's paired with one of the newer, more logical and annoying android models, and he pushes him out of a moving car when he gets too much, and then he gets paired with an older, more emotional, discontinued model, and that's Dorian, who you just heard, played by Michael Ealy. So I have to say, I wasn't that impressed with Carl Urban's character, John Kenick's. His character is so kind of standard issue, cranky, depressed cop getting vengeance that I really found it hard to care about him or any of his troubles. I didn't really care if he finds the crime syndicate that ambushed him or that his ex-girlfriend, who was also pretty generic, was in that syndicate. He's kind of a Bruce Willis ripoff. You've seen this character a million times before. Also, Minka Kelly from Friday Night Lights turns up as another cop in the force, but she made no impression in the pilot, and I didn't see any sparks between her and Kenick, so I'm sure they're going in that direction, but wasn't evident. But the one thing I loved about this show, it's my favorite of the three, is Dorian, played by Michael Ealy. I love that this show is basically about emotional intelligence. You can tell the world of the show doesn't value it. That's why this model of robot was discontinued. But because these robots are unpredictable, just like anybody with emotions is. But clearly the show's creators want to explore how emotional intelligence can solve crime and save Kenick's soul. And that's, I think, a nice antidote to all the kind of left brain crime series out there, even House, you know, all valuing kind of deductive reasoning. This one is about emotional intelligence. So, and apparently John Larroquette is coming on this show. That's fun. This one hasn't even aired yet. I got to see a little preview copy. It's starting next week.
And looking at the trailer, it does look beautiful. Do you think this is a good example of showing now what Canadian technicians and craftspeople can do in Vancouver as a result of all the different series that have come and based themselves out of the hood?
I mean, our locations are pretty fantastic, and I love how they've kind of turned the Cambie Bridge in Vancouver into this, just with some CGI in the background to make it all futuristic, but it makes you realize how very modern a lot of our vistas are, and we also have had such great special effects houses in Vancouver for so many years that I'm pretty sure they're using some local talent. But I have to say, I mean, these series are American ones shot in Vancouver. It's pretty much all American and British actors, which I only noticed a few kind of local actors in the small roles, like Alice's father or Friar Tuck or the, you know, various side robots kind of get to be the local actors. So we can't give Canada too much credit for these series. It's our location, and I know for sure our local crews and our local special effects. So, and, you know, a lot of money pumped into these for sure.
That was Kim Linekin, CBC's pop culture columnist in Vancouver, talking to Gillian DeBias.
And with that, very sadly, we must bring a close to our weekly review show. It's goodbye from us here at Midori House. Thanks for listening. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilboa and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Claire Urban, and our researcher was Rosie Sells.
Georgina Godwin is back in the studio now to continue her weekend programming with the curator, Monocle's Best Of radio show, which presents some of the unmissable highlights from the last week on Monocle 24.
But you've been listening to The Review with me, Clemency Burton Hill, and Chloe Potter. Have a great weekend.
Goodbye.